all in support of a great cause. So take a look on Facebook for GAN Rocks, and I'm looking forward to seeing you at GAN Spring Rock 2026 on April the 25th.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Attention Ontario pickleball players. The Maple Leaf Pickleball Club invites you to the Smash for a Cause charity tournament in support of Jumpstart Charities. This action-packed day of competition and community spirit takes place at the Fairgrounds Racquet Club in Hamilton, Ontario, Sunday, April 26th. Whether you're playing for fun or for the podium, there are prizes to be won. And don't miss the battle for the coveted Maple Leaf Cup. Smash for a Cause. Register now at MapleLeafPickleball.org. That's MapleLeafPickleball.org.
Welcome to Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. On this episode, the end of Israeli superiority. We hear about a Palestinian death penalty bill.
After the right to torture Palestinians, apartheid Israel claims the right to hang Palestinians.
A reporter in southern Lebanon tells us about what Israel's annexation attempts look like on the ground.
Each new day in Lebanon brings fresh reports of an attack on a village, a neighborhood, and a family's mourning loved ones, but also of a resistance.
An organizer from New York is the target of a foiled assassination plot as she takes the far right to court.
Because it doesn't just happen to me, it happens to everyone, but in particular, as a visible Palestinian organizer in the belly of the beast in New York City, you know, someone who wears hijab as well, it really makes me a prime target for groups like Fatah.
And on the resistance report, Yemen joins the war.
And that first operation was multiple Yaffa drones, long-range drones, cruise missiles, and a couple of Palestine 2 ballistic missiles, which are Khyber Sheikh Khan.
This is Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. This episode highlights the news, interviews, and reports from our podcast on March 28th and our live stream broadcast on April 2nd, 2026. Later in the show, we'll be hearing from activist Nardine Kiswani. She's taking the far-right extremist group Beitar USA to court. Their campaign of harassment against her included cash bounties offered to anyone who would physically harm her, and repeated confrontations at demonstrations across New York City. Also, Rokaya Chemsedine filed a report for us from Lebanon. She's a Southern Lebanese researcher, reporter, and co-host of the Delete Your Account podcast. This week on the Resistance Report, John Elmer covers the fifth week of the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. But first, the Electronic Intifada's executive director, Ali Abunima, reports that Israel's parliament passed a Palestinian death penalty bill.
On March 30th, the Israeli Knesset passed a law imposing the death penalty by hanging on Palestinians convicted in its military kangaroo courts of killing Israelis. The law mandates executions within 90 days, sharply restricts appeals and clemency, and is designed to be applied only against Palestinians, not Israeli Jews. It passed by 62-48 with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu voting in favor and National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir celebrating its passage. In one video that we'll take a look at, Ben-Gvir is seen popping champagne after the vote. Diab Abu Jahja, the director of the Hind Rajab Foundation, said that Israel has now become the first state to codify a death sentence that applies in practice to one ethnic group while another is effectively shielded from it. This death penalty targets Palestinians under occupation in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, but also Palestinian citizens of Israel, particularly those in occupied East Jerusalem, according to the legal rights group Adala. Adala immediately petitioned Israel's Supreme Court, arguing that the law adopts an apartheid-like approach to the fundamental right to life. The Israeli human rights group B'Tselem said that the Israel Prison Service has already begun preparing designated facilities to start carrying out executions. According to B'Tselem, the death penalty will be the default sentence, and judges will be able to commute it to life imprisonment only in special circumstances. In addition, the judges will no longer be required to reach a unanimous decision. A simple majority will suffice, and once the sentence has been handed down, there'll be no possibility of a pardon or any reduction of the sentence. Now, it's important to remember that they're talking about Israeli military courts that are used only against Palestinians and which have a 99.7% conviction rate. Palestinian journalists in Gaza have denounced the law as a declaration that Palestinian life is disposable. And in fact, across Palestine, it has been met with outrage, protests, and calls for resistance. The Palestinian prisoners' rights group, Ad-Damir, called on the European Union to immediately suspend its association agreement with Israel. Article 2 of that agreement, which grants Israel many lucrative trade privileges, states that the entire agreement is contingent on Israel respecting human rights. But a reaction from the so-called international community has been muted. The European Union issued what I can only call a shocking statement that failed to condemn the death penalty law. Instead, the EU said only, quote, "We are deeply concerned about the de facto discriminatory nature of the bill." Even worse, the EU praised Israel's human rights record. It stated, quote, "Israel had long upheld a de facto moratorium on both executions and capital punishment sentencing, thereby leading by example in a region despite a complex security environment." This depraved statement ignores the reality, well documented by the UN, Israeli, Palestinian, and international human rights groups, that Israeli personnel routinely and on a shocking scale torture, and that includes sexual torture, and murder Palestinians inside and outside Israeli prisons, crimes that have continued for decades and have only escalated. Some 100 Palestinians are known to have died in Israeli prisons since October 2023, with many unaccounted for. Last month, Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Occupied Palestinian Territories, published a report on Israel's use of torture in the context of genocide. It states, quote, "That torture has become integral to the domination of and punishment inflicted on Palestinian men, women, and children, both through custodial abuse and through a relentless campaign of forced displacement, mass killings, deprivation and destruction of all means of life to inflict long-term collective pain and suffering." Referring to the death penalty law in recent days, Albanese said, "After the right to torture Palestinians, apartheid Israel claims the right to hang Palestinians. The shame of the century continues. Ben-Gvir belongs in The Hague." Now, what the muted and passive European reaction tells us, I think, is that these allegedly human rights-loving states are not actually bothered by the death penalty law because they've never been bothered by Israel's ongoing extrajudicial executions of Palestinians. They are only embarrassed that Israel is formalizing its policy of state murder and making it harder for them to ignore Israel's crimes and pretend that it's a democracy.
That was the Electronic Intifada's Ali Abu Nima. You're listening to Electronic Intifada Radio with me, Nora Barrows-Friedman. Still to come, John Elmer covers the fifth week of the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. But before we hear from him, we go to Lebanon, as Israel attempts to annex the south and is met with resistance. Rakaya Chamsuddin is a southern Lebanese researcher and reporter. She filed this report.
Last week, Israeli forces have significantly escalated their military offensive against Lebanon, once again striking deep into residential neighborhoods and rural communities. Air raids and attacks from Israeli warships have targeted Beirut's southern suburb, also known as Dahiyeh, resulting in significant casualties. In southern Lebanon, the intensity of strikes continues unabated. Villages including Khiam, Jibshit, Kafra, Bint Jbin, and Tibnin, among others, have been hit repeatedly by Israeli bombardment.
Homes, shops, and community centers have been damaged or completely destroyed, and dozens have been killed or wounded. Israel is also continuing with its pattern of attacking medical personnel, including by way of double-tap strikes. To date, Israel has killed 1,318 people and injured 3,935 people in Lebanon since the 2nd of March. Among those killed are more than 55 first responders. Arguably, the most harrowing loss have been the deaths of journalist Haj Ali Shaib of Al Manar and Al Mayadeen's Fatma Ftouneh, along with her brother, photojournalist Mohammed Ftouneh, who were killed when their clearly marked press vehicle was struck by at least four Israeli missiles while they were covering the situation in South Lebanon near the village of Jizin. In reaction to these sustained assaults, Hezbollah has intensified resistance operations against Israeli military positions, conducting coordinated rocket barrages and precision strikes. Armed resistance units have targeted Israeli armored columns and outposts along the border regions, engaging occupation forces with guided missiles and unmanned aerial strikes designed to disrupt troop concentrations and logistical lines. Hezbollah has also targeted over 120 Israeli tanks and military machinery and have been facing Israeli soldiers from point-blank range. These operations, which have resulted in an unknown number of dead Israeli occupation soldiers, are part of a broader strategy of active defense, resisting any attempt by Israeli forces to advance into southern Lebanon and asserting our people's right to defend Lebanese territory in the face of foreign aggression. Southern villages near the border have seen repeated Israeli announcements of the intention to bomb our communities, but many residents refuse to abandon their homes and land, choosing instead to stand firm despite the bombardment. Hezbollah has made it clear that resistance operations will continue as long as Israeli attacks on Lebanese civilians and sovereign territory persist. Hezbollah's leadership has reiterated that actions taken are in direct response to the occupation's military operations against the people of Lebanon. Each new day in Lebanon brings fresh reports of an attack on a village and neighborhood and a family's mourning loved ones, but also of resistance and of Hezbollah units engaging in defensive operations along the front lines. The struggle continues with intensity driven by a determination to protect our land, our people, and the right to self-defense against Israeli aggression. The people of Dahiyeh, South Lebanon, and the Ba'a Valley are still here, and they continue to resist.
That was the Electronic Intifada's contributor, Rokaya Chamsuddin. Still to come on Electronic Intifada Radio, a pro-Israeli extremist was arrested in a plot to kill Nurdin Kiswani. She speaks out. That's a daytime launch of an Iranian Seiji ballistic missile. The Electronic Intifada's John Elmer continues his coverage of the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran on The Resistance Report.
This is The Resistance Report for day 909 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. It's day 34 of the U.S. and Israeli war with Iran, day 31 of the IDF's attempt to annex South Lebanon. Let's get right into it and look at the Strait of Hormuz here, where Trump told everybody yesterday that we have nothing to do with this. So there doesn't appear to be an American plan to run a suicide gauntlet through this area. So for now, anyway, they don't appear to be interested in that. And because of that, the Strait of Hormuz is now essentially a toll booth, taking rials, Iranian currency, for their crude, which is undermining the sanctions regime, and just another element of Iran turning the U.S. strategy on its head here. According to the Israelis, they've dropped 16,000 bombs on Iran. The U.S. says 12,000 targets, which means many more than 16,000 bombs. And of course, their targets, like all wars, the ICRC spoke this week and said that 295 health, medical, and emergency centers have been targeted, 600 schools, 17 Red Crescent medical centers, 48 civil defense vehicles, 46 Red Crescent ambulances have been destroyed, and three medevac helicopters destroyed. And of course, the Americans are now starting to target key infrastructure, destroying critical bridges and a vaccine medical science factory. The topography of the strait of the Iranian mainland in the north, high hills, much overwatch, very difficult for any enemy warship to run that gauntlet. And the American military appears to have convinced Trump that that is simply not going to happen. Iran's National Security Committee has approved a bill that would impose fees on ships passing through the Strait of Hormuz, the official Fars News Agency reported, citing a committee member. The bill, when it becomes law, would impose a toll in rials, which would reverse the currency collapse that the United States imposed upon Iran earlier this year in the lead up to the war. It would ban the passage of U.S. and Israeli vessels through the strait and assert Iran's sovereignty over the strategic waterway, and ban any country that imposes unilateral sanctions against Iran. The Economist had a banger headline this week, "How Iran is Making a Mint Out of Donald Trump's War." So the premier capitalist newspaper and oldest, "How Iran is Making a Mint from Donald Trump's War." Iran is richer. They're exporting more oil. They're exporting it at a higher price. They're trading in Iranian currency through the Hormuz toll booth. All of these things are positives for Iran amidst this war and overthrowing the American strategic objectives in this war. This week also, the Yemeni armed forces joined the war and proposed the closing of the Bab al-Mandab. That is the choke point off the Yemeni coast running up through the Red Sea, which would effectively cut off the Suez Canal and force all traffic around Africa, which it actually already is because of the insurance rates from the previous Yemeni battle in the Red Sea with the U.S. when the U.S. fled and didn't want any part of that. Shipping has largely moved out and around Africa instead of sailing through this. Yahya Sari from the Yemeni Armed Forces announcing this, he said that the implementation of what was stated in the previous statement of the Yemeni Armed Forces regarding the direct military intervention in support of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the resistance fronts in Lebanon, Iraq, and Palestine, and in the view of the continued military escalation, the targeting of infrastructure, and the commission of crimes and massacres against our brothers in Lebanon, Iran, Iraq, and Palestine, the Yemeni armed forces have carried out their first military operation with a batch of ballistic missiles which targeted sensitive sites in the Israeli enemy's heartland. This operation coincided with the heroic operations carried out by the brothers, the fighters in Iran and in Hezbollah in Lebanon, and the operation successfully achieved its goals. Our operations will continue until the announced goals are achieved, as stated in the previous statement by the Yemeni armed forces, until the aggression on all resistance fronts ceases. And that first operation was multiple Yaffa drones, long-range drones, cruise missiles, and a couple of Palestine 2 ballistic missiles, which are Khyber Shaykan, that the Iranians as well use. Let's take a look at some of the assets that the U.S. has lost. Reuters did a nice little graphical picture of what the U.S. has lost. The F-15 Strike Eagles, three of those were shot down by Kuwaiti fighter pilots, friendly fire. One of them was clipped by Iranian air defenses, the F-35A, the Lightning II. It was clipped as well. The first time the F-35 has been clipped in battle, it had to do an emergency landing and the pilot was wounded by shrapnel in that operation. And we have another near miss this week. We've got audio in on this. This is an F-18 that is strafing the eastern shoreline of Iran. And you're going to hear the fighter jet strafe and then a shoulder-fired MISAG, man-portable anti-aircraft system, fired at it. Doesn't get much closer than that. So almost had an FA-18 lost, and you can see that strafing run when it's firing its cannon along the shoreline, that becomes a predictable route. And in guerrilla air defense, when you're setting up air defense ambushes, that's the way that you can make them possible. When you are on a predictive route, if you're running that low level strafing raid that's happening here along the coastline, the jets are in predictable position, and that allows the integrated air defense systems to set up ambushes in a particular targeted zone rather than the umbrella defense that we are familiar with the Americans and the Israelis. So far, it's been pretty effective. At least it's shown that it can be effective. I'm not sure we're going to hear it when fighter jets are dropped from the sky. The Americans lying, CENTCOM's lying in this war has been really remarkable, even for somebody who covers military lies for a living. It's been remarkable. We know that they've lost a number of these KC-135 stratotankers. These are strategic aerial refueling tankers. There was seven of them before this week, and a couple more were clipped on the runway at Prince Sultan Air Base in Saudi just the other day. And we know the Reaper drones, the U.S. has admitted to a couple of dozen Reapers shot down. One Reaper kill was on the tarmac at Muwaffaq al-Salti Air Base in Jordan. I think the numbers are higher. The Israelis admit to losing 20 drones so far. So we're talking several dozen at least from the Americans, and from the Iranian side, they put that number significantly higher, up around 100. So we'll see when the accounting all gets made, because we know that these numbers are being covered up. And let's take a look at the next video, because you can see a couple of those interceptions of MQ-9 Reapers that look a lot like the 358 weapon that was being used in Yemen to take down two dozen of them. There's a pair of Reapers from this week being hit by the integrated air defense system. So that is the Iranian army as well as the IRGC. I don't know, a few billion dollars in radars that had been destroyed, part of the THAAD system, and an early warning radar at Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar. It was $1 billion. They've lost multiple of them. Some reports suggest as many as 10 of these Sirius advanced warning radars have been knocked out. That just puts holes in the aerial defense system. It doesn't break the system entirely. The U.S. still tracks with satellites a lot of the launches, but they use these stronger radars in the early warning stage to set up the knock-on radars, the smaller radars that have less capacity. If these early warning radars give them a proper location trajectory, then these weaker radars are successfully able to intercept. If they don't get the early warning accurate, then the smaller radars closer to the ground, they're not able to react in time. And I think we're seeing some of that both in the shortness of sirens before the missiles arrive in Israel, and just straight up the number of missiles that are hitting. Israel talks about 95% interception rate, and it's clearly not even close to that. If it is half, I think I would be surprised at even that number based on the number of missiles that are being launched at Israel and the number that we are seeing hit. Again, those numbers are unclear. We will track those whenever we can to get those figures more solid. This week's major hit was the U.S. IWACS, the Advanced Early Warning Airborne and Control Airplanes. And you can see them there. This is from the Prince Sultan Air Base. And I told you before the war started that the U.S. had concentrated their forces onto three key bases: Prince Sultan here in Saudi Arabia, Muwaffaq al-Salti in Jordan, and also in Ben Gurion, and presumably on air bases in Israel as well. The E3 Sentries are the airborne early warning systems and command. These are very important aircrafts for monitoring the entire battlefield. The U.S. only has 16 of these in total, but they only have 8 that are working at any given moment. And you can see on the runway there in one air base, they have 6 of them. Okay. This is the launch by the IRGC of the drones targeting Prince Sultan Air Base. The multi-launch of the Shahed drones, very accurate, very difficult to shoot down. Launched here in a clear swarm, we're seeing rail launchers, looks like 6 or 8 deep here, launching a massive barrage targeting Prince Sultan Air Base. They said this is part of the 84th wave, and they said they destroyed anti-missile systems and the penetration of solid and liquid fuel missiles into the, they'll call it Al-Kharj base, the Prince Sultan Air Base, and the location of fuel and supply fleet and aerial support targeted with a barrage of missiles and drones. So those were the drones, that plane that you just saw flying into its air base at home, not in very good shape. And you can see directly hit on the radar of the plane. CENTCOM said that planes were, quote unquote, damaged. They were damaged on the runway. And we know the last time they said that, Trump went out and said they're back up in the air. So this is damaged. This is significantly more than damaged. And it's also a direct hit on the radar, which is just shows that they know. And you can see here from a different angle, basically cutting the plane in half. These are really old planes. They use old engines. They are more than 50 years old, and they do not have a deep stock of these. Like I said, they have 18 total that they cannibalize for parts for the other 8 to 9 that are operational. In this attack, it's believed that a second one was hit as well, along with several KC-135 Stratotankers. So very valuable asset, multi-billion dollar assets. Difficult to put a price on the AWACS because they have been maintained to stay in the air for so long, 50 years. So it's long past their price point, but it's more than $1 billion to replace for sure. And so again, taking a significant toll on U.S. military assets in a way that we have not seen in a war since, I mean, presumably since the Second World War. I don't know where you can take out these multi-billion dollar assets in previous wars, even Vietnam or maybe Korea. But we're talking going back multiple generations before we can find losses like this. And as Trump likes to say, no one's ever seen it before. Again, we're looking key targets, Bahrain, Fifth Fleet, the Naval Command for CENTCOM right across the shore from Iran. The UAE is taking the most attacks. UAE, number one ally with Israel. Qatar's Al Udeid Airbase, that is the CENTCOM's key airbase. Muwafaq al Salti in Jordan. And of course, Prince Sultan Airbase just outside of Riyadh in Saudi Arabia. Kuwait is being hammered. There's a number of US bases that were used as hubs during the global war on terror and the war on Iraq that started in the 1990s. Those bases have been hammered and are largely not functioning. Of course, we know that the soldiers have been hid in hotels. And the New York Times had a banger headline the other day that said, placing U.S. troops in Middle Eastern hotels may violate laws of war. So they think that that might be a violation to use human shields intentionally to hide your soldiers who are supposed to be on military bases, but instead are in 5-star hotels in the Gulf. So all that has been consistent. The IRGC talked this week multiple times about the Lebanese Hezbollah resistance and the Islamic resistance in Iraq and Yemen carried out more than 120 successful and effective operations in recent hours against the northern and southern regions of the occupied Palestinian territories and the deployment and hideout headquarters of American commanders in central and northern Iraq, dealing attrition-inducing blows to the exhausted body of the aggressor armies. And you can see in these launches that Iran puts out all the time, they don't see every single launch, but it gives you a sense of what it looks like about all of the, it puts lie to everything basically Trump said in his speech. And the Israelis, they say that they've knocked out 95% of these, but every day we see them launched from various locations. And they're using these missiles. These would be considered old stock missiles. We're still not seeing the Haj Qasem. We're not seeing very much of the Sigil. And the Iranians have admitted this, that they have not opened all of their stores. The IRGC said that the targets for this week were mainly Israel's industrial military base, but also air bases in Ramat Gan, Holon, and Palmakim, which is near Tel Aviv, a major air base and air defense base outside of Tel Aviv. The IRGC Navy was told that it was a race this week. There's Sinwar, Ali Larijani, and Nasrallah being put onto the Hadid 110s. And this is a one-way attack drone that was targeting the Fifth Fleet in Bahrain and early warning radars in Saudi Arabia. The Hadid 110 is a jet-powered suicide drone that is essentially a stealth drone. Its delta wing design is good for radar evasion. Its maximum speed reaches 500 kilometers an hour, which is the fastest of the drone category. It almost effectively operates like a cruise missile, weighs 30 kilo warhead, and have been doing extensive damage throughout the Gulf. They're also very accurate. They're controlled with a man in the loop to get those on target. And again, we've seen this from the IRGC throughout the battle. honoring their leaders, honoring what came before them, honoring even the strikes from the day that they launched these missiles. We also see them poking Americans. They put out one barrage that was dedicated to the American citizens that were murdered on the streets by ICE agents. So just they have a much more aware, politically aware of the United States, clearly, than the United States is of them. If the United States had that awareness, I don't think they would have started this war in this way that is not going to end up the way that they intended to. Artesh drones, these are drones launched by the Iranian army. These are Arash 2 drones. And again, these are kind of split between a cruise missile and a drone. These are long-range strike drones. These were designed to target Israel. The army said, "We targeted the deployment locations of the AWACS aircraft, refueling tankers, and U.S. bases in the region. We have since this morning targeted the deployment location of U.S. AWACS and refueling aircraft stationed at Ben Gurion Airport, the radar site for detecting the intercepted missiles and combat drones, and the electronic warfare sites countering and combating drones in the UAE was hit. These Arash 2 drones have 2,000 kilometer range and were built specifically for enemy air defenses. When they were launched, Brigadier General Haidari, the commander of the Iranian Army Ground Forces, described the Arash 2 as a specialized weapon designed to perform precision strikes and suppress enemy air defenses. So these are for long-range strikes to target Israel. And the Iranian army is taking part in this operation. They want everyone to know that. They're firing these operations off every day. They're also calling them waves. So the army has waves. The IRGC has waves. And also the street has waves. Last night was the 33rd night in a row of people out in the streets all over Iran in different cities protesting, showing solidarity, even though Trump said that it's too dangerous to go outside to take back your country when he said that they could take back their country, which clearly they're in the street for the opposite reason. And they're marking each of those nightly demonstrations. You've probably seen footage from them. There's a lot of interviews of, you know, Vox Pop, people on the street, interviews from those demonstrations that show a wide cross-section of Iranian society, not simply regime supporters, but all across the society. And that's one thing that this war has done, as any war does. It unifies the country that is being targeted. And I want to just wrap with Palestine. Israel Quds released a video this week in solidarity with the Axis of Resistance. Of course, this war started in Gaza. Israel Quds saluting the Yemeni people. Then here's Islamic Jihad founder Fatih Shikaki saying Palestine is the center of the struggle today and will remain so despite all the secret and black agreements. He's speaking about the secret Oslo Accords that were, this is Ayatollah Khamenei. And he's saying the fate of the region depends on the liberation from the arrogant American hegemony and the liberation of Palestine. You're going to see Yahya Sinwar giving his famous speech from the platform on the anniversary of the founding of Hamas. He says, "We will not hesitate to make the decision," he said. And they certainly did not hesitate to make that decision. Abdul Malik al-Houthi from the Yemeni Armed Forces, he said, "Our stance continues." Then there was Ziad Nakala, who is the General Secretary of Islamic Jihad. Then the missile launches that we saw this week. And then Hassan Nasrallah is going to come in here and say, "The final result of this battle and the great divine historic victory is that Netanyahu, Gallant, Ben-Gavir, and Smotrich are leading their entity into an abyss," which is sort of similar to what their chief of staff said when they said they're about to collapse. But we see footage from on the ground in Gaza, some Saraya operations here, Qassam operation, and then missile strikes that we've shown you on this program as well. Yes, this is definitely the end of Israeli superiority. The idea that they could just roll through the Middle East and do what they want is being fiercely resisted by the Axis of Resistance on all fronts. So it's something that they always point out. When the battle was in Gaza, the other resistance factions saluted them. We see the prisoner exchange and handover here, and the Yemeni fighters here at the end. I think they've trained hundreds of thousands of them to fight this battle. The Yemeni armed forces are significantly larger, and here they are walking on Al-Aqsa. So a solidarity video from Saraya al-Quds to the resistance axis. And here, We have the PFLP Abu Ali Mustafa Brigades commenting on the new Israeli execution law. This poster that was put out yesterday says, "We are stronger than death and higher than the gallows," as the fist breaks the gallows, smashing the gallows. And Abu Obeida also spoke this week. He said, "Blessed are the hands of the heroes of the Islamic resistance in Lebanon, which are inflicting heavy losses on the Zionist enemy, the latest during a qualitative operation yesterday. We call on Hezbollah to intensify their efforts to capture soldiers in order to liberate Palestinian and Arab prisoners from the depths of the occupation's prisons, especially after the approval of the law to execute prisoners. We urge the heroes of Hezbollah to complete the mission," is what Abu Obeida said. So that is the resistance report for day 909 of Israel's genocide in Gaza and day 34 of the U.S.-Israeli war against Iran.
That was the Electronic Intifada's John Ilmer. You're listening to Electronic Intifada Radio with me, Nora Barrows-Friedman. We now turn our attention to New York City, where a plot to firebomb the home of a prominent voice and organizer for Palestinian liberation was foiled. The Electronic Intifada's Ali Abunima brings us this interview.
On March 27th, Nadine Kiswani posted a shocking tweet on Twitter X. She wrote, "Late last night, the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force informed me that a plot against my life was about to take place and that agents had conducted an operation in Hoboken, New Jersey, related to this plot." Kiswani is the founder of Within Our Lifetime and is one of the most prominent advocates for Palestinian rights in the United States. The New York Times reported that police and federal officials arrested 26-year-old Alexander Heffler and that 8 Molotov cocktails were found in his apartment. Citing a police official, the newspaper added that Heffler was a member of the JDL 613 Brotherhood, which was inspired by the Jewish Defense League, a pro-Israel group designated by the FBI as a terrorist organization. Prosecutors say that Heffler was planning to flee the United States after carrying out the attack on Kiswani. According to Twitter X user Halal Flow, JDL 613 posted this so-called emergency broadcast less than 2 weeks ago, featuring a person that Halal Flow identifies as group member Eliezer Ben Avraham.
"The Muslims want to kill us. The Muslims hate us. There's no compromise. There's no appeasement. There's no negotiating. There's no making deals. Okay? Don't be afraid of them. Don't trust them. Don't be friends with them. Have nothing to do with them. In fact, we should be gathering intelligence against them, spying on them, following them, finding out where they live, finding out where they work, and stalking them at their mosques, protesting at their mosques, harassing them, and giving them no peace, no peace for the Muslims."
Giving them no peace, no peace for the Muslims. Even before the news of this plot broke, Nadine Kiswani had already filed a lawsuit against several Jewish extremists for stalking and harassing her. We will talk about that and much more with Nadine Kiswani, who joins me now.
Thank you so much, Ali, and the whole team at Electronic Intifada, not just for covering this story, you know, after the fact, but also leading up to it. You know, I felt like I've been screaming into the void about these people and about the inevitable that this was going to happen. And so much mainstream media never covers this, you know, until it's too late, until something big like this happens. But, you know, you guys have been doing the work for so long, you know, to hold them all accountable. So I just wanted to start off with a thank you. And I'm so glad to be here with you today.
Thank you so much, Nadine. And on behalf of myself and all of us at the Electronic Intifada, we're so glad that this plot was uncovered and that you're safe. What can you tell us about how you learned about it and what exactly you were told?
I got a call around 9 p.m. I was sitting with my husband and my son. He's almost 10 months old, and I just got a no caller ID number late at night. I don't answer because I assume it's a Zionist harassing me or some, you know, other strange thing. And the calls won't stop. They keep repeating. Then I get a call from my sister that my father's receiving these calls. Now my brother's receiving these calls, different family members. And then finally, my brother picks up and the person on the other side says that he's an FBI agent. Don't worry, you know, no one's in trouble. But I have something to tell you regarding Nardine's safety. That's what he says, you know, after he confirms that he's my brother. But he tells them that he can't tell him what's going on. He can only speak to me directly. So I call up my lawyers who are representing me on the Bitar lawsuit. And we call the FBI together, who tell me that there was an imminent threat about to take place on my life. And, you know, they apprehended the suspect. He was arrested. And, you know, that they don't think that I'm in danger anymore. You know, I tried to ask for more information about the nature of the threat, who the person was. They wouldn't tell me anything except for the one thing we got out of them was that the arrest was made in Hoboken, New Jersey. So, you know, I really, you know, didn't have much to go off of. They basically told me they're not allowed to tell me anything, but that I would find out about it in the news tomorrow. It's going to be a big story, which, you know, raised alarm bells in my head. And also the fact that the person who called me was an FBI agent, so it wasn't a local issue, it's federal, and that he was a member of the Joint Terrorism Task Force. So, you know, alarm bells go off in my head, FBI, terrorism, and yeah, the very little information that the arrest was made in Hoboken, you know, did make it a little easier to look into the Citizen app, different posts online about activity, counterterrorism activity happening in Hoboken. And one of the first things I see the night before, you know, before I'm told anything, is that somebody with a yarmulke was arrested. And, you know, I already could had a feeling, I had a gut feeling, and I was right about where this was going.
That's absolutely bone-chilling, especially as you mentioned, you have a young child, and the very idea of your home being firebombed or worse, and I'm thinking of how the settlers in the West Bank routinely firebomb the homes of Palestinians there, and it seems like they wanted to bring that type of violence to you in New York. I'm kind of surprised that the FBI was working to protect you. Were you surprised by that?
I mean, you know, I've been talking about this for so long. I've been documenting all of the threats, intimidation, harassment against me by different Zionist groups. And this specific group, the JDL 613, have explicitly on Twitter say things to me like, me and my disgusting child should not be living in the U.S., should not exist in the U.S., and that, you know, my time is coming. They're always watching. And so, you know, I think any law enforcement agency, after repeated warnings from, you know, all of the social media posts I've made, the ongoing lawsuit I have against Bitar, would just look incompetent, to be honest, if they couldn't anticipate something like this. So, you know, I really think they would have to look the other way and really just, you know, look ridiculous for them not to do, you know, anything about it at all. But, you know, you are right that, you know, oftentimes federal law enforcement has looked away before, whether it's, you know, with the firebombing of Alex Oda's offices by the JDL, by the same group that this group is an offshoot of. You know, they looked away and the perpetrators were never brought to justice. So it really could have went, you know, any other way. I just think in this climate and, you know, my outspokenness online is really one of the things that protected me here.
Well, we're very glad about that. But, you know, as we'll discuss, the danger is definitely ongoing because these groups are still out there. But Nardine, what was striking to me about the New York Times article reporting about this incident is that it seemed to me that it spent more time regurgitating attacks on you and your activism than it did talking about the organized campaign of hatred and violent incitement that you have faced for years. Talk about what that has been like. You did mention a little bit how your other family members get this harassment, but talk about what it has been like to be Nardine Kiswani these last couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, for so many people who look at this headline and think that it's surprising, to me, it's not, because this did not come out of nowhere. It was a materialization of years of organized hatred and public incitement. I've just felt like I've been screaming into the void, begging people, begging elected officials, people in power to look at us, really look at us and understand that, you know, we're humans too, we're people too. And we shouldn't have to face worrying about, you know, our children being killed, our families being killed and being doxxed, threatened, stalked, harassed. Exactly what, you know, the person in the video clip that you played was basically instructing, you know, Zionists to do, simply because, you know, we don't believe that other children should be bombed and firebombed. You know, I look at my son and I think about Ali Dawabshi, the Palestinian infant in the West Bank who was burned to death, that, you know, settlers brag about and enjoy talking about, you know, how they, I think they use the term like barbecued him before. So, I mean, I know that that's what they want to do to us, and it's not an extrapolation, it's not an exaggeration, it's not an anti-Semitic blood libel conspiracy theory to say that they literally target, you know, our children and our women in particular. And so, you know, this coordinated harassment is something that really needed to be reckoned with, because it doesn't just happen to me, it happens to everyone, but in particular, as a visible Palestinian organizer in the belly of the beast in New York City, you know, someone who wears hijab as well and who's outspoken as I am, you know, outside of just the liberal framework, but really a liberatory framework when it comes to Palestine, it really makes me a prime target for groups like Batar and aligned actors who have worked to make me a symbol to attack in order to intimidate the broader Palestine movement. They want to use me as a message. And I've never, you know, been naive about that, that the goal isn't just to personally target me, but to send the message that Palestinians who organize, speak, and resist will be terrorized into silence. And, you know, what's striking about mainstream coverage, like you mentioned with the New York Times, is that they spent more time rehearsing attacks on my activism than examining the ecosystem of hate that made this violence possible. You know, essentially spending more time questioning me, the target, the victim, blaming the victim, than the people inciting violence against me, which normalizes that exact violence. You know, they are just as complicit in it, you know, and along with elected officials like Randy Fine, to...
He's the Florida congressman who is just notoriously and openly anti-Muslim and anti-Palestinian, almost in a Nazi-like way, openly celebrating the killings of Palestinians in Gaza, for example.
And celebrating this attack. I mean, he responded to me, my announcement of the assassination plot, with a flag that has a dog on it that says, "Don't tread on me," kind of, you know, saying that I had it coming. So, you know, there's been a long-running harassment campaign, and any forms of accountability that these Zionist groups or individuals have faced have really been nothing more than a slap on the wrist.
And I do think it's fair to call what the New York Times did, even when they're reporting on this plot against you, I think it's fair to call it victim blaming. Nerdine, you have been a strong, and I would say also a principled critic of New York Mayor Zohran Mamdani, especially during his campaign. But he came out with a strong statement denouncing the plot to attack you. Mamdani wrote, "A member of an offshoot of the Jewish Defense League designated by the FBI as a known violent extremist organization was allegedly building explosive devices to target the home of Nerdine Kiswani in a chilling act of political violence. The defendant reportedly planned to flee to Israel following the attack. This comes amid an alarming rise in threats and violence across the country targeting Palestinian human rights advocates." What was your reaction to Mayor Zohran Mamdani's statement?
You know, I really appreciated that he named this for what it was, political violence targeting somebody who's myself, you know, an activist for the Palestinian rights and Palestinian liberation. So he didn't hide behind vague language. You know, he named me explicitly. He named our movement explicitly. And he identified, you know, that this was a Jewish extremist. I also learned through his statement, I didn't, you know, see it and reporting before or hear from, you know, any law enforcement confirmation that he was planning to run off to Israel, although, you know, that's what I suspected. So it was also, you know, really just confirming everything that I feared and everything that I expected, you know, through that statement. So, you know, like you said, I have been a critic of him, but I appreciated his statement, not because it showed support of me, but because, you know, I do believe it was a principled statement, and that, you know, you don't need political agreement to condemn an assassination plot, and that his statement was morally and politically clear.
Now, you mentioned several times you made reference to the group Bitar. Let's talk a bit more about that. In January, the New York Attorney General found that members of Bitar, which is another extremist Jewish group, engaged in an illegal coordinated harassment campaign targeting Palestine activists. And this included acts of violence, doxing, issuing threats, and encouraging others to carry weapons to intimidate and physically confront Palestine solidarity protesters at public events. And for example, at an 18th February 2025 Palestine solidarity rally in Brooklyn's Borough Park neighborhood, Bitar members attacked protesters and at least one activist was stabbed, according to the Attorney General's investigation. Under a civil settlement, Bitar agreed to shut down its operations in New York without admitting any wrongdoing. And so far, no one has faced any criminal charges for these actions. Last month, you filed a lawsuit in federal court in New York against Bitar and some of its principal figures. Tell us about the lawsuit and what you're asking for.
Yeah, so I mean, I think it really is important to underscore the connection of the lawsuit within this incident, because the assassination plot has to be understood within the broader ecosystem of extremist incitement. And, you know, I don't think it's a coincidence that I announced my lawsuit at the end of February. And, you know, according to the indicting papers, this individual, you know, who planned to carry out this attack, you know, staked out my home on March 4th, you know, just a week later. So, you know, I filed this lawsuit as a plaintiff through my attorneys under the Anti-KKK Act of 1871, you know, alleging that they violated my civil rights by making it impossible for me to exist in public life. And, you know, that's only gotten worse now. You know, every time I left my home, I was fearful of being harassed, of being attacked. You know, they put an $1,800 bounty on my head saying that, you know, they're going to give that money to anybody, or that reward to anybody who would hand me a beeper. And of course, you know, as you know, that harkens back to the beeper attack by Israel on, you know, so many people, particularly in Lebanon, where, you know, Lebanese children were left maimed and disabled and blinded, you know, due to these terrorist attacks. So essentially, you know, inciting terrorist harassment. And that's what the lawsuit, you know, seeks to address, because, you know, even though the Attorney General found that Bitar engaged in this activity, they didn't even get fined for it. You know, how can you say that somebody was stabbed and all of this was happening and there's no criminal prosecution? So the threats, doxing, encouragement of violence, physical intimidation, following me around, taking videos of me, chanting my name at protests, encouraging people to throw things at me during protests from skyscrapers. It really made it impossible for me to feel like I can leave my house, or that I can even attend protests or public events. So, you know, whenever people like me are targeted for our political activity, for our identity, our religion, by, you know, such extremist organizations like the TARs, it creates the conditions for attempted, you know, political violence. And that's exactly what we saw here. This is a result of their harassment and incitement. So, you know, the lawsuit is about accountability, seeking to hold Bitar and its leadership and its, you know, possibly even affiliates responsible for this coordinated campaign as a civil rights violation. And you know, bigger than me personally, it's about protecting the right of Palestinians and all advocates to organize without terror and intimidation. So, you know, I think without a criminal prosecution and with the cop-out that they got through the Attorney General's office, this basically allows their campaign to continue unchecked. I mean, they're supposed to be disbanded in New York, but they're still harassing me on Twitter. They're still calling for my denaturalization, which, you know, I do think that they have the influence and power to bring about, because they work with the administration. And there's, you know, public court documents that shows that people in DHS who've lined people up for deportation, who've detained people, have gotten names from some of these Palestinian activists from Bitar. They've said this, you know, in court. So, you know, if this continues to be allowed to go on unchecked, it sets a dangerous precedent for political repression in this country. You know, actually a precedent that has been cemented time and time again, but, you know, it would have only made things worse. So, you know, we're calling for not just damages for the harm caused, but also an example made out of them to make sure that they don't continue the harassment, for accountability for the individuals and entities involved, and recognition that this conduct violates civil rights protection. So other Zionist organizations, individuals, and groups don't think that they can just go harass and attack and, you know, essentially have people charge at and try to physically harm, you know, other people simply for speaking out against genocide and for Palestinian liberation.
And I think that impunity and immunity that they feel is such a big part of it. And so I hear your message that you're trying to bring accountability so that perhaps others will think twice. This lawsuit is in its early stages. You filed it just about a month ago.
That a lot of our pleas, you know, all of this documentation of this harassment will be ignored if there isn't a captive audience that's, you know, holding accountable the people in power, the people who have the power to hold Batar accountable. And so if there is that demand, you know, I do think that, you know, they would give this a little more attention than the blind eye that they've turned, you know, to it for years at this point.
And I know from experience, Nadine, that that kind of community support is essential because you may know that I filed several lawsuits in Switzerland after I was falsely and unlawfully arrested in January 2025. And we've won so far three cases. I know from my own experience how important that is and how powerful these kinds of legal actions can be. So, Nadine, we are so grateful to you for spending time with us. It shocked us all. I can't say it surprised us, but it shocked us all with the news that came out. And we're very glad to see you safe. And we pray for your continued safety and for everyone to be aware and to stand together and to speak out and to protect each other in these really troubling times. And I'll say this, just, you know, they would not be coming after you like they are. I truly believe this. If you were not such an effective, dignified, informed, and fearless spokesperson for the cause you believe in, that's why you threaten them.
And you understand that more than anyone, as someone who embodies all those traits and more, and somebody that I've looked up to, you know, ever since I invited you to come speak at my college. And
that was in 2014. I remember it very well. As a community, we are very lucky and proud to have you as one of our very best. And
well, I wouldn't be who I was if I didn't have the Electronic Intifada to read us. I remember at the time, the only source on Palestine. And we have so many sources now, but you guys are truly the blueprint. And so, you know, at least in the English language. And I really respect and admire all of the work that you and your team do. And I'm always here to speak to you and prioritize you all, you know, even above any other outlet, as people who've been doing this out of principle, with consistency and with fearlessness and taking your own personal risks. As you mentioned, you know, congratulations on the lawsuit. But, you know, we were all praying and in fearful for you when we saw your detention and the attacks that you faced throughout the year. So thank you so much again. And I'm always honored to speak with you all.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Nadine.
That was Nadine Kiswani speaking with the Electronic Intifada's Ali Abonima. Thank you for tuning into Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. For more interviews, reports, and analysis, along with feature articles, podcasts, and our live stream, check out electronicintifada.net. Produced by Pierre Loisel, Nora Barrows-Friedman, and Tamara Nassar. The Electronic Intifada is a program service of the Middle East Cultural and Charitable Society, Incorporated, a 501c3 nonprofit organization.
He who controls the spice controls the universe.
When the clock strikes midnight, the night truly begins. Step into the darkness on CFRC's Retro Radio Show, diving deep into the sounds of the past, from haunting classics to underground gems. This is DJ Terry, and every Friday night at midnight till 2 a.m., tune your dial to 101.9 or CFRC.ca and let the music pull you in.
you win.
Roll the dice on Saturday nights at 11 p.m. with CFRC's Radio Roulette. Every week, we get a new randomly generated playlist courtesy of the